Blog Talk Radio.
I'm just mad about saffron. Oh, saffron's mad about me. I'm just mad about saffron. She's just mad about me. They call me Mellow Yellow, quite rightly. They call me Mellow Yellow, quite rightly. They call me Mellow Yellow. I'm just mad about 14. A 14's mad about me.
In San Francisco, to popularize the hippie culture, it would lead to the Summer of Love of 1967. Although this social phenomenon of counterculture interest included politics, drugs, and a love peace philosophy, central to the scene was the artistic world of music, painting, and fashion. From various areas of London and Britain, where the Beatles provided an anthem to this movement with All You Need Is Love, to Greenwich Village in Manhattan on the East Coast, the social spirit of youth quickly spread, but the epicenter of the psychedelic flower power world was the Haight-Ashbury neighborhood of San Francisco, where at its zenith, 100,000 mostly young people converged. With the release of Sgt. Pepper, the growing popularity of outdoor music festivals, with the improvement of sound, technology highlighted by the Monterey Pop Festival, and the amazing music, it was a summer to remember 50 years ago. We're going to be talking tonight about the Summer of Love 1967, the golden anniversary of this. And one thing I want to just start off before I introduce John and David Timmons and we get going on the show. One of the things that I just want people to know is that under no circumstances are we highlighting drugs, or are we talking about condoning drugs or anything like that? Because what has happened, and we're going to talk about this tonight, is that with the experimentation of drugs, and it was used during music of the Beatles and different groups of this time, and it was a part of the Summer of Love. We just want everyone to know that the Timmons Brothers and John Talk Radio, we do not condone it in any way or glorify the use of drugs. And we've seen what it's done to a lot of the musicians that we wish were here today. So I just wanted to put that out there. And with that, I'd like to introduce John and David Timmons. And thank you, guys, and welcome to the show.
How you doing, John? And I enjoy what you said there. That is true. I don't condone that at all. It's just that time period.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things. Yeah, go ahead, John.
I was going to say, glad to be here. I remember Paul McCartney saying that at one time, this is in the Summer of Love, 67, and they asked him about doing LSD and drugs, and he was the last Beatle to do it. And he was like, do I bluff it, or do I come forward and tell the truth? He decided to tell the truth, and that's when the Beatles went under the microscope then. But he said that he admitted there were dangers in taking it, but he said he had a purpose in mind to find an answer to what life is all about, you know, at the time. And
yeah,
it was exploration.
Yeah, and that's definitely a part of it. There's no going around it. Timothy Leary, the experimentation, it was kind of a religion in a way. It was a way of looking inside yourself. It was a way of looking at you know, different parts of the mind that no one had looked at before. And it was a time that where you know, I've read a lot, and you guys have read a lot about, you know, musicians thought that they could, it would enhance their music, and it would open up parts of their mind that had been closed off. We can't say that that didn't happen, and we can't condemn it totally, but we can look back now 50 years later and say that you want to kind of look at the drug problem we have today and the addiction problem that we have today, and we're kind of thinking. One other thing, guys, I just wanted to say, and this has been heavy on my mind, and I've said this in a lot of my shows lately, that everybody has this stigma of drugs, sex, drugs, and rock and roll with you know, that time of period. And a lot of people, you know, and that's absolutely true, no doubt about it. But there is rock and roll without that. It doesn't have to
Definitely.
Be that way. There are people, I always say Ricky Bird, who was the lead guitar player with Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, who's now a big advocate for recovery. He does all these shows. He's been clean and sober for almost 30 years, and he looks back at that and he thinks about how many people they lost and what, you know, what could have happened if some of those folks would have been not been involved in that. So I just want people to know that if, you know, people get involved in rock and roll, that's not a necessity. You don't have
hey,
to do
John,
that.
John, you brought up a good point. I know when John and I do shows together, they're very convinced if you've been in rock and roll, been in a band or anything, they think you don't have to do that stuff. And I think that's why one of my rock and roll heroes is Paul Revere and the Raiders. The Raiders made wonderful music, never had to experiment like that. And Paul would actually fire a member if they did, wouldn't he, John?
Yeah, yeah. Right,
and
you know, and carry on too with this, you know, and I imagine we'll talk a little more about this later on. But George Harrison was one of the Beatles. Actually, went to San Francisco during the summer of '67, the Summer of Love.
Right, yeah.
And what he was thinking he was going to find was like people selling arts and crafts on every street corner and finding this inner spirit. And he said by the time he got there, it was a lot of young runaways, drugged out, and he saw what it was doing to some of these teenagers. And he said that was really the day that he decided that he was going to stop doing LSD. He looked underneath the microscope, and he saw these little ropes that were sort of hanging him, like the way it was shaped. And he decided that was the time to give this up, which... That's when he made that, you know, that was the kind of commitment he made the rest of his life.
John, you're right. And he got very strong spiritually then too, and he got into that, and that's right before he'd go to India. And then there's another character that went there named Brian Jones, though, for the opposite reasons. As we think of all the Rolling Stones, the only Rolling Stone that actually was at the Monterey Pop Festival was Brian Jones. So that's amazing about that.
Yeah, and that's a great point, David. And it's like back then, one of the things that, you know, I think is very interesting is that you said this, John, that it was experimentation. It was going down paths that no one had been down before. It was new. It was exciting. And that's where I think a lot of it, you know, would draw people in. It was like the music, the dress, the way people were thinking, the counterculture, the use of drugs. And there was a lot of that, like the releasing of the old school, the way of thinking, the way of looking at things. There was Vietnam. There was all this happening and going on. And there had to be some type of purging of that certain philosophy. And that philosophy was purged by the new culture, the peace and love. And let's don't kill people.
Exactly. And you had the cultural war like you brought up. And then you get to think about fashion. I can remember how fashion changed when I was in the seventh grade at that time in 1967. And I bought a pair of maroon pants. And everybody said, hey, he's cool. I didn't wear blue jeans. They were maroon like the Beatles wore. And I think fashion came thing. The bright collars was coming out. Nehru jackets. And I think we saw from the 50s where the Elvis look of leather, and I think it was a more open atmosphere, and the music itself would change. You get thinking that not only do we have the Beatles, we got a young Lou Reed forming the Velvet Underground at that time. A totally different sound than what we would be hearing from that time period. Pink Floyd is developing a Piper at the Gates at Dawn. It would be totally different sound, and I think that's what I always said about this time period. This took away some groups, like the happy-go-lucky groups, I call them, and had that bubblegum sound, and I think progressive tones of music was, and the music itself was changing very, very major.
Yeah, and you can look at it also from, I know this sounds weird, and I said this once, and it went to a lot of minor chord progressions instead of your major chord progressions. And a lot of that was different because, like you're talking about, a three-chord major chord progression song sounded very controlled. Everything was cool. And then you started getting off on these different progressions musically. And like you mentioned Pink Floyd and the Moody Blues and all these bands started to do things that were they would stimulate your thinking and the way you would listen, and it did change things. I can remember, you know, you had this culture, guys, that was Dean Martin and all of these different guys with the smoking cigarettes and drinking drinks and the Rat Pack and dressed in suits and that whole lifestyle and the Las Vegas lifestyle and that whole thing. Well, that, the summer of 67, the summer of love, that just split that right down the middle. And what do you think of that? Because it went from this cult, this kind of a lounge culture. Now we're talking about, if it feels good, do it. That was kind of how it was.
Well, John, you know, with the Rat Pack and the wearing the suits and the smoking cigarette, there was like a transition getting to 67, though, because the Beatles were wearing their suits with the special kind of collars, and they were all dressed alike when they first came to America. And most of the British invasion bands, even the Rolling Stones at first, were all dressed in nice suits, and they would dress alike. So
that was
sort of making a compromise, getting in touch with what was there in the past, what people were used to, but not taking this this kind of a quantum leap to now we're just having longer shaggy hair and we're wearing these bright colored outfits that don't even match. There was like a transitional period of 64, 65.
Yeah.
La La Jim Morrison.
Yeah.
Oh, no one actually, it's a great point, David, because he brought it, he kind of took it to another level where
yes,
it was like,
did.
Okay, so we're going to have freedom of thought. We're going to have all of this. I'll show you what freedom of thought is. And it, like on the stage in Florida, what, you know, when they, what he did there and all the different things that happened. But I think it's, and it's something, John, that you probably talk about some of your classes you do, is how that, you know, people as a whole look to these superstars or they look to these leaders, they look to the Beatles, the Stones, the Who, as somebody that they can mimic and they can try to be like and emulate. But that's not always the best thing to do. What do you think that those bands, do you think that responsibility was ever really understood by those young kids, those young musicians, that what they did was going to be mimicked and spread through the world?
Well, I read Paul McCartney's biography. Paul and John did not realize the influence they was going to have on that generation. If you remember, even in 64, the guys started growing their hair long overnight. And I think the young people, you got to remember, these were the boomers we talk about now, and they saw this. It's a big social change. We're going, we're changing so much. We got the Vietnam War going on. The pressure that when you turn 19, more than likely, if you're a guy, you're going to be in the jungle before you're 20. And I think the rock and roll and their influence was in such influence that if one of the members of a band burned a draft card, we're going to burn a draft card too. And I think Stephen Stills pointed this out best if on the song For What It's Worth. It was young people speaking their minds. And I think this is the first time the young people was willing to step up. And if you listen to a lot of the songs, basically this was it. And it was just, I think it was a social change. And I think it was a big thing that we would see that proved one thing. If you group together, and this culture was what they would have their own communes and stuff. And it's just amazing me, the social change was so strong. And the rock guys, some of them were worshipped like gods to some of them. I know they would, if the Beatles said, all you need is love, that's all it took for some of them to think that. So it's amazing.
Yeah. What do you think, John, about the was there a conscious decision by those guys, or were they just, was it driven by money? Was it driven by their managers? I mean, it affected the way people dressed. And you have to look at, like you said, the Beatles wore suits and had the shaggy hair. But by this time now, they're starting to, you know, to dress in more crazier colors. There's not so much as the macho or the man and woman look now. It's more blended. It's a lot of the barriers are falling down. You can look back at that, and maybe some preachers or somebody might look at that and say that was the fall of society, of structure. What do you think of that?
And I think some people do say that, you know, that as far as from a point of kind of a of the ministry, that was the sort of the benchmark, if you will, when those kind of changes took place. My thought is that groups like The Who, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, I think when they first set out, they really just wanted to play music. They were musicians. They wanted to get their music out. And I don't think they really realized the influence it could have. But by 1967, yes, they did. I think by that point, it was contrived. I mean, the Beatles knew they were the spokespeople for a generation by that point. And that's why they knew if they did a satellite performance of All You Need Is Love, it would command you know, millions and millions of people watching it in many countries. And they knew they had that kind of power. And so they had to give thought, like, if they do something, what kind of influence is this going to have? And I think, you know, they use that example. I think they try to use that as a positive one. They were all the they had all the kind of sandwich boards and all the different kind of languages for all you need is love. I think that told them at that point, that was an indication they knew the kind of power they had of influence.
And that's a great point, too, because especially John Lennon was very outspoken against the war and against violence and against and he was for human rights big time. And now you've got, like you said, you've got these groups that were musicians that now have a heavier responsibility. You can look back. I know this sounds weird, but look back at some of the bands that didn't do any of that. I mean, there were bands that just played music and didn't really care whether they changed the mind or the ideology of anyone. But then there were, you know, you could throw out like Herman's Hermits and Freddie and the Dreamers and bands like that that were just happy to just play, you know. But then you had these groups, and David brought up the Doors. I mean, my goodness, they were really interested in changing the way you thought.
Oh, I want to bring up another band who would make their debut in 1967, Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. They would turn 67 upside down. And they made their first album called Freak Out. Nobody even knew what Freak Out meant then. But how well I remember.
No,
Yeah, and the cover of it had them dressed up like little old ladies. And there was another big shock. But then again, another sample of what we call that Asbury sound. And how well I remember this, our oldest brother had that 8-track tape, and I would play that over and over. I said, "This is different." I think I wore it out for him, didn't I, John?
Oh yeah, you did.
You'd listen to their songs, but they would actually have things about what was going on, and you just think about these groups. Then you brought up there's groups like the Box Tops and them. They would go ahead and have their hits and get by, but I think what affected all this, a lot of these groups would fade out by 68 because they wanted social issues in their songs. And I think the group, then Bubblegum comes back a little bit, but affect the Bubblegum sound a lot.
Oh, I'm glad it did, because that was pretty annoying. But I just want to tell the people out there that if you would like to talk to John and David or me, if that's what you would like to do, call 877-694-5613. And when you do that, it will ask you to prompt to speak to the host. And when you do that, then I get a little thing that pops up because the phone numbers can come up. And if you have that little, "I want to speak to the host" pops up, then I will click you into the show. And you can talk to us, and we would love to have your view. If you have a story about that time, and any kind of, even if you weren't at, you know, during that period of time, but that, like we've said so far in the show, it has influenced us today. And 50 years later, people are still trying, guys, to get back to that. You see all these young groups that are trying to be like hippies and psychedelic and all that stuff. This is nothing that those guys were trying to do. That was actually happening. I know we've got some great music lined up. We're going to play the Beatles' All You Need Is Love here in a second. We've got the Loving Spoonful, Summer in the City, Mamas and Papas, Creek Alley. We've got Jefferson Airplane, my favorite, Somebody to Love. I think that just is one of the greatest songs of that era. That just makes me think of that time when I was a kid and I would go to my buddy's houses and hear that song. And like you said, David, with Frank Zappa being so different, see, I thought that music was really different.
Oh, yeah, it was. Yeah, but when he had the Mothers of Invention, I want to bring up a note about Mellow Yellow for the opening. A lot of people don't realize in the background, that's Paul McCartney yelling in the background. Paul enjoyed setting in with Donovan. But
what is he saying?
Yeah, he was a big fan of him. Well, he was so convinced that he wanted, and Donovan actually does some backup vocals on Sergeant Pepper. So it's that's how close it was on them two there. But
yeah, I was trying to figure out what the background vocals were saying, but maybe that's
you know. To me, it's like Paul McCartney uses that similar kind of voice at times. It's kind of like, you know, kind of a yip, 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 you know, where he's just kind of doing nothing, just mumbo jumbo. And he sort of did a little bit of
yeah.
that in the song Hey Bulldog when at times. I mean, he does the dog yipe and everything, but he does some other, just you can't really sort of tell exactly what is he saying just to make you question it, you know.
Yeah, it was an interesting song. So I ask you, John, what was when you chose the music, what part did you think Donovan had with that period of time?
I think that Donovan was like the person that people connected with. He seemed to be the kind of could become a friend easily with a lot of the artists. I'm the more I read about Donovan, I'm amazed. He must have been like a person who was just so easygoing that I don't think you ever read about anyone disliking him. Like everybody just enjoyed having him around, and his song "Mellow Yellow," he claims it's been misunderstood. But you know, at the time,
I thought it was a bottle of pop.
At the time, now from what I've heard, it was rumored that you could get high on smoking dried banana skins. Hence, Mellow Yellow, you know, but it came out, you know, and he said, no, that wasn't nothing like that, even though he refers in the lyrics to electrical banana, you know.
I got a good Donovan story to tell when John gets done.
Go ahead, Dave.
Oh, I read his biography. Tommy Smothers has a party at his house in 1967. The Mamas and the Papas are there. Couple of the Rolling Stones, all the members of Paul Revere Narrators. Well, Donovan says he walks in there, and like John said, he's just a happy-go-lucky everybody likes. And he said the party's going on. He said the smoke's in the air. And he said I felt like I was on another planet. but he was your happy-go-lucky guy.
Well, he also was your first kind of. Clone of Bob Dylan when his
yeah.
early music, and people really kind of connected him with that. But he had so much more than just, you know,
emulating
Dylan. he had actually a voice you could understand the words. Not to say something bad about Bob Dylan, because he is who he is. And
great songwriter.
Great songwriter, interesting guy. But let's play All You Need Is Love. What would you like to say about that song? Because it's one of those songs we've heard a million times, but sometimes you just have to clear all that out of your head to really listen to something, to think, okay, I know I've heard it a bunch of times, but what is this? What would it be like to be in the studio when they were laying that down and to hear that, you know, in its early infant stages? What do you guys think of that song, and how does it connect with today's world and with tonight's topic?
I'll let John go first.
It's the anthem of the summer of love. I mean, it comes out in the middle of the summer of 67. It's called All You Need Is Love. I think of it as the way of showing the Beatles were really in touch with the vibe that they were feeling, that they were sensing. And you know, the summer of love, you could say that was a small world, mainly England, America, and certain countries in Europe, and mainly in major cities. But where were your musical artists? They were in these countries. They were in these cities, and there was just a lot going on. And I think that the Beatles used it as an opportunity to try to galvanize people, try to think about peace, love, and what it can stand for. And I think that sort of the semblance when I mentioned earlier about the sandwich boards and all the different languages of saying all you need is love. If you listen to the song, George Martin was able, who was the producer of it, there was able to include other forms of genres of music that Kit fitted in, everything from Glenn Miller In the Mood to a little bit of Bach to even other Beatles songs performed earlier. So if the people out there listening want to try to catch where I'm talking about, it was really amazing. It just wasn't really one song. It even uses the national anthem at the beginning for the country of France.
One of the key things I want to point out is Brian Wilson hears this, and this is where he first gives up the idea. He said, if the Beatles are working on this, what is Sgt. Pepper going to sound like down the road? And John brought up a good point. Paul McCartney brings out a little bit of the 64 Beatles with a few yow, yow, yows in it. But what this represented, the Beatles wanted world peace, and I think John Lennon's influence of this song is very strong. If you think about Give Peace a Chance he would make later down the road, I think this was the first time we're going to hear what John Lennon really thought about the Vietnam War, the social scene. And I think a lot of this is heavily Lennon influence, I think.
Well, let's hear it. This is All You Need Is Love, the Beatles. You're listening to John Talk Radio, and this is our May the 13th, 2017 show. My guests are John and David Timmons. You can go on their website, timmonsrock.com. We'll talk more about what they've got coming up this summer right after this. Love is all you need. We want to thank everybody for supporting John Talk Radio and independent showcase for all these years we've been on. We're going into our ninth year. We are in our ninth year. We really appreciate it. We appreciate John and David Timmons coming on the show. We've been doing this for several years, and we really appreciate what you guys bring to the show, and it's always great to have you. So I would just want to say thank you. And I know that you have a trivia show coming up in July 1st, I believe, in Sterling. Would you like to talk about that a little bit, or some of the other things you may be having come up this summer?
All right, John. Yeah, we will, for Ohio, we'll be doing the show we've done, I think it was Dave, the 8th one now,
this
a trivia show
we do
in Mount Sterling, Ohio, as part of their festival. Saturday, July 1 at 2 o'clock at the Community Center in Mount Sterling there. And each time we do a show there in the summer, it's usually the debut of a show. Every time we've done
free.
Every show, we have never done anywhere
there,
else. And so whenever people see us do the show in Mount Sterling, they're seeing it for the first time. And we do several shows, but usually they were we get feedback, we see how they go over, believe it or not, we use Mount Sterling as kind of a test market, and then we take it from there when we go to other places working on our shows.
And the
well,
key thing
great.
I tell people is this is free. We when we go down south and go to the universities, it's not. And I tell people, I said, get a chance. And we test a lot of things, just like John said, to see if it works or not. If it don't work, we know it doesn't. And you get to catch our mistakes live if we do.
And that's
and I think we're also working on a live presentation. I don't know when we'll be doing it, but working on a live presentation of tonight's topic, the Summer of Love with the 50th anniversary, too. And when we do a live presentation, of course, we make it multimedia. We'll have slides, we'll have films, and so on.
And we're preparing for some high school reunions, too. We got that right now. And also, I'm working on a solo project right now with for all the classes when they have their class thing in Mount Sterling here, and they have their class reunions. I'm going to be doing a special thing on 67 there too. So we're going to be busy, but I always love for people to turn out, and I guarantee you one thing, John and I, when you've been there, JD, it's never a dull moment.
No, it's a lot of fun, and we really, really have a good time going, and it's just really family-oriented entertainment, too,
yeah.
So
very,
that's
very,
really
very,
good.
It's all G. I want to tell people, it's all G. It's good, clean entertainment.
And that's good to hear. Marcy and I are going to see the Moody Blues that day on July 1st, so we'll be heading out to the Fraze Pavilion in Kettering, Ohio, right after your show. So that's going to be great.
Rock and roll day.
I've never
you have a big rock and roll day.
Yeah, I've never seen the Moody
will
Blues.
Will you be on the seesaw?
My seesaw, right. I can't wait. I've just always wanted to see them, and it just sounds like – you know, everyone I've talked to, guys, has said their concerts are amazing.
John,
and
I saw them at Kings Island in the summer of 1984, and it was most original band still then. At that point, I don't think they had Michael Pender anymore for some reason. I think everybody else was still in the band. And I do remember them doing a very long version live of Knights in White Satin, and even the flute part even went longer than you're used to. I mean, they really show their craft when you've seen them perform live. I mean, that's the impression I remember from 1984.
Well, they're doing their first set is all the hits, and their second set is they're doing Days of Future Past in its entirety of the album.
One classic album.
That'll be fun, and it's outdoors, and it's just a really cool place. So that'll be fun. So let's continue on. And there is a caller in the queue, and he doesn't have his little flag up to talk, but I'm going to ask you if he wants to talk anyway. If he doesn't, he doesn't have to talk, but I'll ask him anyway. 740-506-4575. Do you have anything for the Timmons brothers?
I have plenty for John and Dave.
Well, we welcome you, and it's you're on.
Hey, John Davis, Fran from Lebanon.
How you doing, buddy? Good
it's
to hear
Fran.
From you. How's the Poconos?
They're wonderful. They're wonderful. A little wet,
great.
But they're wonderful.
Great.
So This has been a great show thus far. And, you know, I find it hard to believe that it would probably take a marathon, like a 24-hour marathon, to talk about the Summer of Love. And one thing that I kind of picked up on with Sergeant Pepper, story goes that Paul McCartney took an early pressing of the album out to San Francisco. And if anything, it seems to me, from what I've read, that kind of gave the official stamp of approval for what was going on in San Francisco at that time.
That's a real story, Fran. That actually happened. Yes. Yeah. I've heard Paul talk about it in interviews and in his book. And it's amazing how iconic that was. The hippie culture out there ate it up.
I was just wondering, guys, how that worked with copyrights and all that kind of stuff, with you know, the release of the record and the media part and the management part. How he got away with doing that?
I think EMI flipped their wig when they did hear about it. But the Beatles were the Beatles. EMI had to give in to them. Hey, you guys sell a lot of records for us. We better not get you guys mad.
Yeah. Well, there's always that part.
Well, let me ask you something, Fran. This is John. In the summer of 67, I have read, like, wherever you went, people were playing Sgt. Pepper. It became like the backdrop theme of the soundtrack of the summer. Do you have any particular memories that summer of being places and hearing people talk about Sgt. Pepper or it being played?
Well, I'll tell you, let me take that in a slightly different direction. In 67 in Philadelphia, where I grew up, and was hanging still there from the college days. There were a couple of things going on there. In Philadelphia, there was a place called the Electric Factory. Big Brother and Janis Joplin played there. I think Hendrix played there at one point. It was an old warehouse in downtown Philadelphia. And there was a mayor at the time, Mayor Frank Rizzo, who was a law and order guy. In fact, he was at one time the chief of police, and they called him the Cisco Kid, because when he was an inspector, there was a tenderloin district along Locust Street in Philadelphia, and he would go in there and break up all the, shall we say, the parties that were going on down there.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, what Rizzo did, he wasn't really didn't understand the Summer of Love. And something or other, he got the Electric Factory's license revoked. And when that happened, he had the whole building demolished.
Wow. Was this right downtown Philadelphia, was it at the time, Fran, basically?
No. This was like around 20th and around 20th and Arch, just off of downtown. I mean, in downtown, but off the, you know. And the thing that gets me, you were talking earlier about the fashions and the you look at the mamas and the papas, and they were kind of funky, and then Spanky and our gang, they were kind of not as funky, but funky. But what got me about the Summer of Love was that all of a sudden on radio, you started hearing 8-minute cuts, at least on the FM side. Whereas on AM, it was still, you know, within that three minute limitation. And,
wife,
you know,
Fran,
all of a sudden,
you brought up
you
a good
start
point,
hearing,
Fran, called, yeah.
You start hearing all these long versions of Light My Fire.
Oh, I love that.
And Moody Blues Uninterrupted. I mean, you know, it was really something. And speaking of the Moody Blues, friends of mine, and John and Dave, I think I may have mentioned this to you one time before when I was out there in Ohio. A friend of ours had a basement, and he decided, because the girls who were hanging around, they were a little bit on the hippie side, okay? Well, we turned John's basement, I should say John turned his basement, his parents said it was okay, into basically a psychedelic club. Now, I don't know if the,
Hey, Fran, what, did they do it on the Moody Blues Tuesday afternoon?
Yeah, everything was on there. In fact, the stereo system was one from, was a Sylvania. It was a Sylvania portable, and the sound that came out of that was unbelievable. But the, what our friend did, he worked at a gas station part-time, and Atlantic Richfield at the time had these little Red Balls that you could put on your antenna because it was all Red Balls. Well, he must have gotten, I don't know, 50 of them and hung them from the ceiling in the basement, then got the black lights, and somehow or other even got a fire plug and a stoplight. And the rest is history down there. I tell you,
Francis, the only thing they needed there was the strawberry alarm clock playing then. Was Philadelphia really in? You know, Philadelphia, I know, was always into R&B. It sounds like to me they really got into electric rock there in 67 then.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And, you know, you're talking about 67, getting away from, shall we say, the real, I think, J.D., you had mentioned the idea that some of these bands in 67 played just for music. And you had mentioned, in fact, John, I think you brought up, you know, the box tops and the letter. And if you look at some of the other things that, you know, were more top 40, things like Spooky, Young Girl, Judy in Disguise. That Judy in Disguise, you know, did seem to me to have had to be influenced by the Beatles. There's no doubt in my mind.
Yeah, I agree.
I agree with you. Yes, because you could. Hey, you brought up a good point too. But here's what I brought up, Fran and JD and John. I've discussed this on the program tonight. The big thing I noticed that happened to groups like the Box Tops and them. Can we compete with the sound that they're doing now? And I think that's kind of hurt those bands. I'll use the Day Clark 5 for the best example. After 1967, the Day Clark 5 had hits, but they were never the powerhouse band they were before Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
By the same token, Jerry and the Pacemakers.
Yes.
Yeah, that whole kind of genre of music where we were talking earlier, Fran, about how it was kind of cookie cutter. It had the three-minute songs with the lot of major chords and a little hook there, and it was very well packaged, and it was put out there to make people dance and to sell records. And I think when 67 came around, it was a little different now. Now instead of just doing that little formula – now it's like, let's put some stuff about the war. Now let's talk a little bit about the way you're supposed to actually treat people or how you're supposed to live. And, you know, the story you had, Fran, about the mayor, and he was going to stamp out the hippies. You know, that was happening in every big city. It was like, we can't have the hippies doing this crazy, long hair, crazy hippies. And it was one of the things that I thought was, you know, I remember that time. And I remember, you know, there was a little bit later on, in the late 60s and the 70s, when I went to college and there was the riots and there was this big division of, you know, people, one side or the other. And music had a whole lot to do with that.
I got to bring up a comment about what Jim Morrison said. Fran, you'll like this. Jim Morrison quoted, Edgar Allan Poe had blown back as a hippie.
Well, you know, J.D., what you're just saying about, you know, the love come together. You know, the Youngbloods, they did Get Together.
Oh, I love that, yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
8 Miles High, you guys. The Byrds, and John, you remember, my brother John can tell you this, the original 8 Miles High was meant to be played for 9 minutes. The record label had to cut it to 4:50. We was talking about length of records. Probably one of the best songs the Byrds ever made, and everybody interprets that song differently. To me, I think it's on a plane trip taking 8 miles. I don't want to get in the other.
Yeah, let's just do that. Yeah, let's do that, David. I agree with you there. I mean, you could go into when you got the songs, you can just go into so many things. Why don't we play a couple songs? John's given me some great music to play. Let's play Love and Spoonful, Summer in the City, and the Mamas and the Papas Creek Alley. Would you anybody like to talk about them? We'll take a little break. We'll play some music. We'll come back and we'll try to wrap up some of the important things maybe we haven't touched on. This is one of those subjects, like you said, Fran, where you could talk about this around the clock. There is so much to talk about.
Yeah, because in Philadelphia also, as one of you, John or Dave, mentioned, Philadelphia R&B, I mean, there were some great things happening at that time as well. And you know, you don't... It was a minor portion, shall we say, of the Summer of Love.
John Timmons, would you like to say anything about Summer in the City and Creek Alley?
For Summer in the City, the sound effects, I think the reason that we chose this song because it really epitomizes summer with the sound of a drill, with the sound of a car horn, and you just sense this. Walking in a hot city in the downtown area.
Philadelphia.
And, it could be Philadelphia. I mean, and I really like the way the Lemon Spoonful is able to articulate the kind of an ambiance. And then as for Creek Alley, I ask the listeners out there, try to catch the different kind of references they make to their own history, their own background, as well as other artists. There are several other artists they mention in that song.
Okay. And we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much for listening tonight. We'll be right back with our study on the Summer of Love 1967. And hang around. We'll be right back.
In the city, back of my neck getting dirty and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match here. But at night, it's a different world. Go out and find a girl. Come on, and dance all night. Despite the heat, it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer. In the city, in the summer, in the city. In the city, dressed so fine and looking so pretty. Cool cat looking for a kitty, gonna look in every corner of the city. Till I'm wheezing like a bus stop, running up the stairs, gonna meet you on the rooftop. But at night it's a different world. Go out and find a girl. Come on, if that's all night. Just like the heat, it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer. In the city, in the summer, in the city.
looking for a penny, trying to get a fish on the line.
In a coffee house, the bastard sat, and after every number, they passed the hat.
McQueen and McGuire just are getting higher in L.A., you know where that's at.
And no one's getting fat except Mama Cat. Cass was a sophomore, planned to go to Swarthmore, but she changed her mind one day. Standing on the turnpike, saw him out to hitchhike, take her to New York right away.
When Jenny met Cass, he gave a love bomb.
Old Johnny saw, and that was the most fun.
McQueen and McGuire couldn't get no higher, but that's what they were aiming at.
And no one's getting fat except Mama Cat. Mugwumps, high jumps, low slumps, big bumps, don't you work as hard as you play.
Make up, break up,
everything is shake up. Yes, it had to be that way.
Sebastian and just a catching fire in L.A., you know where that's at.
And everybody's getting fat except Mama Cat. Disgusted, agents can't be trusted, and then she wants to go to the sea.
Cass can't make it, she says we'll have to fake it.
We knew she'd come eventually.
Greasing on American Express cars
and low rent,
but keeping out the heat.
Because vibrations in our imaginations can't go on indefinitely. And California dreaming is becoming a reality.
And we're back on John Talk Radio. This is our, I can't believe it's May already, and it's the 13th. Just to say happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. It's tomorrow, and that'll be a lot of fun. And thank you, because we wouldn't be here without you. And let's see. Great songs. I got to stump the Timmons brothers, but this is a shooting a fish in a barrel, guys. I think you guys know so much about this time period, and I really couldn't come up with anything that I thought, wow, this may get them, but I'm going to do it anyway. But it's pretty easy. You ready?
Okay. Yeah, I'm ready, John.
Okay. You guys are ready.
I was going to say before you ask a question, I was going to say, if any listeners out there realize the connection, I like how you played those songs back to back, because Mamas and Papas, they're referring to Love and Spoonful several times in Creek Alley when they refer to Zal. That'd be Zal Yanofsky, who was a member along with John Sebastian, Love and Spoonful. And they referred, because they were in a group called the Mugwumps together, Zal was.
Right.
And it's really interesting. Then they refer to McGuire and they referred to Roger McGuinn, thank you, Barry McGuire, you know.
Lawrence Welk.
And the fact that you played
Barry McGuire.
back to back. Yeah, Barry McGuire. Is this that? Was it more than coincidence, or you know? I mean,
Yeah, it's cool.
I just want to note the fact you played them back to back, and I appreciate that.
We love
or
it when
Mitch
a plan
Miller
comes
like
together.
That.
Yeah, Mitch didn't like any of this music. He doesn't.
No,
he hates rock and roll. Okay, here's the question. We talked about Sgt. Pepper. Sgt. Pepper was number one for quite a long time in 1967. There was one album that knocked it out of its number one chart. It became number one. Can you name the artist and the name of the album?
It had to be the summer of 67, I guess. It had to be the summer of 67, right? You know, I mean...
It was a summer of 67. Sgt. Pepper's was, I don't know if it was exactly a summer, but it was in 1967. Sgt. Pepper's was number one, and it got knocked out by this album. Da 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 da.
I'm going to go with The Doors.
Okay.
I'm going to say The Doors' debut album.
I'm going to go with the Monkees' Headquarters.
Okay. Fran, what do you think?
Let's see. It wouldn't be Carole King.
No, but you're in the right. You're in the right gender.
Not Aretha Franklin. Definitely not.
Would it be Bobby Gentry?
Yep. Bobby Gentry, Ode to Billy Joel.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I thought I got thinking about it, and I don't have a Yahoo, guys. It's Bobby Gentry. Hey, friend, when you went female, I said, it's got to be Bobby Gentry.
Well, Glenn, you know what's funny about that? Think of the contrast between those two albums. Can you get more of a contrast between those two albums? It's incredible.
And I think that's... And I think that's why I missed it, because automatically I zoned in onto rock and roll. I did not really think of more of a, you know, a different genre and so on.
Well, it was, actually it was the Billboard Hot 100 chart. It wasn't the country chart. It was the same chart. It was the Billboard Hot 100 chart. Yeah.
Right.
So that broke through. And that is a really good song. I mean, it
hey,
really
that's a good
is.
Trivia question, John. That was a good
You know,
question.
One reason why
I got that, I got thinking about Capitol Records. And then when you both went Aretha Franklin and them, I said, well, Glenn Campbell's old flame was Bobby Gentry. So he was a lineman for the county, so he had to know her. So I put two and two together.
Yeah, there you go. And she's still around. And
is she still alive?
Yes, she is, and she lives down south. She doesn't perform anymore, but she, boy, what that would be an incredible interview. But she's it's really cool. It's just that's kind of how you know we've talked about the American the taste of the American public with their music, how it can change and. The psychedelic sounds and the things that were happening, but people still love a good song, and no matter what it
look
is.
Look at Engelbert Humperdinck in 67. He had several number one hits, and he's a household name. but he did have some hits.
Tom
I think
Jones.
He's one of Fran's favorite singers.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What about Scott McKenzie?
Yeah, we've got him queued up. Our next two songs we're going to play here in probably about 2 minutes are going to be my favorite, which is Jefferson Airplane's Somebody to Love and Scott McKenzie's San Francisco. Now, let's talk about those a little bit, guys, before we play them, because I am a huge Jefferson Airplane / I even love Jefferson Starship. I love Starship. I love the whole thing. And I think when I look back at my own life when I was that age, when I was 16 years old at that time, I remember hearing Jefferson Airplane, and I remember going to some friend's house and sitting down and listening to that music and thought, what is happening? This is something, because the female vocal, the kind of the this different style, the guitar style, that kind of loose ends there. It was like it was something that I don't remember hearing before. And then you connected it with all of the things that you were hearing about, like you were saying, John, about Haight Ashbury and about all this stuff going on in California, which we're thinking in our heads, that's like the moon or another planet, because, you know, we had never been there. And all this stuff was happening, and all these messages were coming back about this revolution, the people that were turning the world around. And I always think of Jefferson Airplane as being one of the top bands in that. What do you guys think
very
of that?
Very psychedelic.
And very innovative and different. And
John, didn't you see him in concert once? My brother John.
I saw Starship two summers ago with Paul Kantner's last concert. It was before he passed away. And it was something that I sit and think about sometimes, because he is a incredible legend in rock history. And when we went to see him, we weren't sure, because he had cancer and he had canceled a lot of shows, and he played that night, and it was just like amazing. But I've never seen
him. Is Cassidy gone now?
Is he dead?
In the band?
I don't think so.
I was wondering. Did my brother John, didn't you see him once too?
Yeah, I saw when they were the Jefferson Starship.
Okay.
And that was that period though where it had some members of Airplane. You still had Paul Kantner, and you still had Grace Slick, and it was good. And John, when you're getting ready to play the song here, I think that up until 1967, I really don't think there were that many live concerts where, I guess I'll use the term, international regions finally started to kind of meet each other and kind of have to build this kind of a hybrid sound, because it was the Monterey Pop Festival that kind of brought the East Coast sounds over to San Francisco, There was Brity acts, there was acts from Britain like The Who there. And
yep.
I think that's what made the Monterey Pop, as far as a landmark festival. And
yep.
Jefferson Starship deserves credit for really bringing that San Francisco sound on a commercial level. There was other people doing it, but they're the ones that really made it a national sound and even attracted more attention to that San Francisco sound.
John, you brought up a good point. While the Grateful Dead couldn't do that, they were that out there in San Francisco, but you're right, it was the Jefferson Airplane that brought that there. And you brought up Monterey, and this is where we also got the eventually makings of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. The Birds were out there at the same time with the Buffalo Springfields, and this is where we interact with some of those members, and so we kind of got that developed there. But that San Francisco sound, John, I got to agree with you guys. It had to be Jefferson Airplane that put it across the world.
When the truth is found to be
Scott McKenzie with San Francisco, Jefferson Airplane with Somebody to Love. Great songs, man. That makes me feel good to listen to that.
Hey, JD, where's MacArthur's Park?
Oh, man, that's going to be in the next edition.
I think he lost. Hey, Fran, I think it's the cake was left there, and I think he had to bake it.
And we left it out in the rain, and it's a mess. There is so much music to play around 1967.
Stumper.
Oh, my gosh. It's unbelievable. When I was looking into the show this week, and I was thinking about it, and I was thinking about all the music and the different types of music, and like you were talking about, Fran, with the rhythm and blues and the soul music and the great songs that were just flooded into our heads back then. It was just incredible. I really appreciate, you know, the music and the artist, and there's never going to be anything like it ever again, I don't think.
Hey,
just,
Fran, you remember 1967, your favorite group, the Tremolos, made their first 45.
Well, you know, there'll be nothing like Top 40 as that hit its zenith just into the, you know, the mid-60s into 67 a little bit. But I have a stumper, I think, for you guys. You ready?
Yep.
We're all three of us.
All right, here we go. Who did the Sparrows become?
Steppenwolf.
No more calls. We have a...
I think John's correct. Yeah. You know, it seems funny how a little sparrow can end up turning into a wolf, though. It had to be born to be wild.
Ooh, that's a good one. That's a good one, David. Now,
it is.
So we got 15 minutes left. What do you want to talk about, John and David and Fran? What are something that we've missed, something that you think is very specific to this time that's very important to discuss in this in the show in the last 15 minutes?
I'd like to talk a little bit about them. Go ahead, Fran.
Hello.
Okay.
What about the grassroots and let's live for today?
Yeah, that's good.
That that kind of encompasses what that hippie movement was. Live for today. They really didn't worry about paying the mortgage at that time.
Yeah, you're right. It was like let's be in the moment. You know, let's enjoy things and let's enjoy each other and let's dance like we're crazy, because there's still people.
Yeah.
If you go to concerts that you see people, I remember that time, man, people danced weird. It was not any kind of like rhythm to it. It was just arms and legs and just having, you know, like they say, dance like nobody's looking. Well, that's exactly what David talked about the Grateful Dead. If you got any concerts like that, you're going to see a whole lot of people dancing like that. It's like,
oh yeah. Hey,
yeah.
John, bring up what you, John. Hey, Fran, John's got a good point he brought up to his 67 class. Hey, John, tell Fran about what you told your class about 67, about the 60s.
Well, I was going to say that with 1967, it was really kind of a watershed moment for rock and roll. If we can talk about the Monterey Pop Festival, because when the Beatles were performing live during their tours, of course, most of the audience, they were cheering. The Beatles couldn't hear themselves, and they stopped touring
right.
in 66. But in 1967, there were these dramatic improvements in sound systems, and it was quite obvious if you watched the soundtrack to the Monterey Pop Festival. There is one scene there where when the birds are coming out, you can hear it is Crosby. He's saying to Chris Hillman, great sound system, hey, and working on their sound check. And I always wonder if the Beatles would have kept touring. You know, that really changed things for live concerts. And also, John, as you were saying, people started to dance at concerts. You know, when the Beatles were performing, when the Rolling Stones were performing, the British Invasion, most people would cheer and they'd scream, but not really dancing.
Yeah.
But by 67, if we want to call it dancing, they were moving their bodies around, you know.
It was a weird dancing. There's no doubt about that.
You know what, David Crosby, when I told Chris Hillman, I said, I couldn't believe that sound, Chris. And Roger looked at me and said, be quiet, David.
Well, we used to call that kind of dancing interpretive folk dancing.
Yeah, that's it. Interpretive is the correct way to put that. But as far as like, John, what else do you think is so wow? It like stands out because that period of time, if you go back, now we're going back and we're looking at it and we're thinking, okay, we've played some great music. Is there any other, and we're going to end tonight with one of the greatest songs of all time in that era, Iron Butterflies, in A Gotta Da Vida, which is like,
whoa,
that's just, you could do a whole show on that song.
Oh, well, the Simpsons, remember the church lady passed out playing that on the organ.
Oh, I love the Simpsons. The more I think about The Simpsons, the better they are. You know, I used to not like
Homer,
that show, but it's like, oh, it's
John,
so funny.
John, when Homer made a comment, he said, that's the only him I know.
Oh, that's funny. In A Gotta Da Vida.
The other comment I was going to have that relates to changes of 67 being sort of a cataclysmic year was the lighting. And they really started using more of a light system. And a lot of that goes back to Ken Kesey and his traveling bus of, it was the Merry Pranksters. And they were doing acid trips up and down the West Coast, and they would rent out these huge warehouses, and the people would be freaking out because they'd bring in light shows. And really, that would influence rock and roll to start. If you think about it, when you see the old films of the Beatles performing live, there was not a light show. But by 1967... they started to incorporate these different kind of lights and now when you go to a concert, sometimes the laser and the lights supersede the actual performance.
Pink Floyd,
oh,
for
yeah.
example. Here's a key thing I want to say about 67, too. One of the greatest artists past got killed in a plane crash, and I think you all know who this was, Otis Redding.
Yeah, I love Otis.
And you get think about, he brought that sound everywhere, and we was talking about R&B, Fran. I think when he passed, got killed in that plane crash, we always wonder what Otis would have done throughout the 60s if he hadn't got killed in the plane crash. And
yet, Wilson Pickett seems to have picked up the mantle, so to speak.
Yes. Yes, I think so. But there's so much of 67, and my brother John brought up a good point. The light shows got big. Guitar solos, guys, got really big. And if you remember when the Beatles and Stones and all them first came, you didn't have a 10-minute guitar solo. Well, that would come with the Jeff Beck group. They would form in. You had Cream, Iron Butterfly, and that guitar solo, and then the Yardbirds when Jimmy Page would take over for Beck. And this would continue well into the 70s. And your lead singer back then, he would carry on more, a la Jim Morrison again, but we had more guitar solos, you had more drum solos, and this, I think, rock actually progressed more in 67, and we're still seeing it yet to this day.
Here's another question for you guys. I've tossed this up. 50 years ago today in 1967, on May the 13th, what was the number one song on the Hot 100 Billboard charts 50 years ago today? That's kind of a tough one. So
that's tough one to pick out.
I'm going to guess they were very popular, Diana Ross and Supremes.
You got it. What's the song?
Wow, very good, Dave.
I'm going to say between two songs. Well, Happening.
It's The Happening?
I'll say The Happening.
You're right. Ding, 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 ding.
Oh. Hey,
you're
I finally got one right.
David's on fire.
The reason why I got that, I saw it on a PBS last night.
Oh, that's a great song. I got that song going on in my head.
Yeah, that's a good song.
Didn't that come from the movie Don't Stop the Music? That was a split screen kind of a thing.
I don't remember that.
That was the Village People, wasn't it?
No, not back then.
Oh, hey, John, you remember the movie that?
I think Fran's right. I think it was like a split screen movie, and that was used in the soundtrack.
But guys, I'll be truthful with you. I would have never got that question. I hadn't watched PBS. See, you learn something every day watching PBS.
You're always practicing and ready for the Stump the Timmons Brothers, David. You're always ready. You and you got the answer. That is awesome. So, guys, a couple minutes left. What do we want to say in closing? Let's go with Fran. What do you got?
Well, I would say 67 for me was one of the greatest times in terms of not just – I was just starting to appreciate like Disraeli years. And then where I was going into was pretty much R&B at that time. But 67 to me was the watershed year, and that was really when I guess got immersed into top 40, and then getting into this thing like there was a station in Philadelphia, WMMR FM, which had the Marconi Experiment, and that was just alternative rock. And you know, you started, whoa, what is this? This is starting to, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, you're listening to 8-minute cuts. So that was my watershed year for seeing how the whole music industry evolved and metamorphosed into what we have today, I guess.
Great. Thank you. How about you, David?
I found safe for 60, Sam, for me. I was a 7th grader. I remember it well. It would change music for me. La La, the Raiders was still my favorite band, but yet I realized there was a new sound coming out, and I got to appreciate this sound. And for me, it was giving me a chance to buy my first Paisley shirt, and I still have one, and my peace necklace. So, I think to me it'll be the icon of music.
Good one. How about you, John?
When I teach a course on the 1960s for college students, I will tell you where they're coming from. When we get to the year 1967, that is their when they sort of stereotype the 60s, we have reached how they identify with the 60s. They identify with the miniskirt, Mary Quant doing, you know, designing. They identify with the tie-dye, with the beads, with the bright collars, flower power, the brightly collared Vans. That is their 60s when it begins, even though it was 60 to 66. That's what they picture in their mind when they think of the 60s. So for me, that's what 1967 does. It reaches other generations who have not lived it but have read about it, heard about it. It epitomizes to them what is the 60s.
Yeah, and it's something that just keeps living. And then I also think of Austin Powers. Those movies are so funny.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I like them.
I do, too. I think they're great. Well, guys, thank you so much. Thanks, Fran, for your contribution tonight. Thanks, John and David. We really appreciate it. Guys, you know, we just have had so much fun tonight. We could do another couple of hours, but
definitely.
We got to say good night. And let's play Homer Simpson's favorite hymn.
And John, if I could just mention one more time, I know you mentioned earlier, yeah, timmonsrock.com. You can read more about us and hear about what's going on in the world of rock and roll. We put
and
things there about, the,
July,
about the history of rock and roll.
And see us in Sterling.
Thank you so much, guys. Everybody have a great evening. We'll talk to you later. And peace and love.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.